I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that, too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers, while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
If you're serious about getting better at mixing and producing, this is for you. Our Patreon gives you access to weekly ad-free technical episodes, plus a library of over 250 past episodes packed with mixing, mastering, and production knowledge you won't find anywhere else. Don't miss out. Join now at mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start learning today. Welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Laughing Lou.
You know, because of this past weekend, my laughs were sounding the funniest I've ever heard them on Sunday. My voice was so gone after doing three back-to-back nights at front of house for NAMM and then also the convention for 3 days that it literally sounded like I was squealing on the most basic of laughs. Like, I sounded like a pig.
Talking about, like, losing your voice, it sounds like, like, you've only regained back about 98% of your voice. Like, I can tell that it's still residually a little bit lost, but almost all there.
Yeah, I have that, you ever lose your voice and you can kind of feel the vibration of the loss? Does that make sense? Like, your voice, there's something resonating. I don't know.
Yeah, I
can't tell. But yeah, well, I can feel
it. Welcome back to this episode. We have something fun that I did not introduce to Lou or talk to Lou about it at all. I want him to react, and we're going to talk about this together. First off, I need to make a proper endorsement. I'm not paid by this company. This guy does not know me. He doesn't even follow me back on Instagram. Not that that matters.
Hey, man, but, follow us back.
But I mean, I'm saying that to prove how legitimate my love for this is. There are some people that insist on wanting to know what book I recommend for mixing or for recording in general. And my answer is very sad and unfortunate. I say that other than the ones that they make you read for, like, school, which are, like, very technical.
What is, like, it? The Assistant Engineer's Handbook?
Yeah, like, the Audio Engineering Handbook. Like, the most one is, like, the Bobby Ausinski ones. Mixing Secrets from Sound on Sound. Modern Recording Techniques. That's the one that I had to get for school, which I like cracked open a couple times. And like, as much as those are like technical about audio and sometimes about like the oftentimes, like electrical engineering, general electrical engineering and like signal flow, for example, I think is more like electrical engineering, possibly, or at least within the categories, like how capacitors work or change sound. Right. And then, along with general physics, acoustics, and stuff like that. As much as that information's great, they're not that practical to most people. And they're not practical for the reasons that you want them to be. Because I'm not like the wealthiest person in the world, but like, I'm not making the big bucks from mixing just because I know anything, any information from that book. And the problem with these books is that music is a forever changing industry. Like, yes, there's the Glyn John technique or whatever the hell it is for overheads on a drum kit.
Yeah.
But like how that affects the sound, and that was popular for a specific season at a specific time because of a specific guy in studio, and it's still useful, but like And it's good to know that information. But let's say that you're a student that knows nothing and you like somehow get into your mind that this is the ultimate way to record drums. Now it just actually removes the creative process. And it should be the entry to experimentation. But anyway, lots of feelings about it. I don't really have a book. The best thing for learning is either just doing it and fucking up and messing up. And honestly, I say like YouTube videos is better than any one book. That being said, I do have a book that's better than any YouTube video. And this is what we're going to pull from. I'm only about 30, 40 pages in, and it's already something that I highly recommend. I will give my final verdict after I finish it. I'm always in between 4 different books or so, and I just read whatever book I'm feeling. Right now, I'm finishing up Pachinko, which I've talked about on my Instagram. I'm finishing up a couple other books, but this is another one that I started recently. This is called Zen and the Art of Mixing by Mixer Man. Mm-hmm. Zen and the Art of Mixing. The name has been pulled and stolen from another book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
What is Mixer Man's real name?
Eric.
I think Freak. I met him this weekend, or maybe it's a different guy, but I think I remember seeing somebody I was introduced to by a friend of mine, and I think it said Mixer Man on his tag.
Maybe he's an older cat. His name is Eric Serafin.
I'll look Eric Serafin. I'll look up a picture.
Serafin is a crazy last name for any Christians out there. That's any Abrahamic believers out there. Serafin is crazy. Anyway, Zen and the Art of Mixing. It's also available on Spotify. If you're a subscriber of Spotify, it's on Spotify right now, as well as like Apple Books. And the audiobook is available that he's self-narrated. Anyway, the point is, this is great. This is fantastic. It's not technical in the sense that you want it to be, but it is practical. For example, he talks about the general relationship dynamics between managers, A&R, and the artist within the first 50 pages. And I think that's significantly more practical than how to dial in an 1176.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I think for super beginners, dialing at 1176. But that's the thing. It's like, I feel like YouTube videos with audio examples of what they're talking about is better than any book when it comes to explaining what an 1176 is or a FET compressor is. This book is fantastic. It's really well written so far, and it's great. Mixer Man, shout out to you. I highly endorse this. It's on Amazon as well. The book you can get on his website or on Amazon. Fucking get this book. This is great. And I'm going to open up to page, 16 and 17, where we're going to talk about Mixer Man's 10 steps to better mixing. And we're going to talk about these 10 steps. I love rule, step number 8. We'll get to 8. And I have a lot to talk about 8. Mixer Man's 10 steps to better mixing, Lou. Number 1, mixing is an attitude.
Cool.
Wait, is that that? Number 1, mixing is an attitude. How do you feel about that?
I think it showcases across most people's mixes, like their kind of vibe, the way they approach things. I could see that. Like everybody has a unique, different kind of taste in their approach to it. So if your attitude is what's being on display, I could see that.
Mixing is not a technical skill in the sense that like, it's not something, it's not like welding, which is something that just needs to be done in a specific way. And whoever's better is just better at welding that one specific way. There is no one specific way. So it's like, it's how you interpret the music. It's how you feel the music and then allow using your tools to allow for that transference of emotion. That's what I think mixing is an attitude is. What else? Anything you want to add to that one?
No, not really. Cause I feel like this is something we've talked about before.
Yeah. Like, many times.
Where we talk about like, okay, how do you know a mix is good? And part of it is like, have we actually preserved like what's there, what we believe to be there? You know, are we actually enhancing what we believe the song is trying to present, or what are we doing? Yeah. We've always talked about how it's less about the tool and rather our approach to getting the song to where the artist intended it to be or what we believe that to be.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Number 2, this is good. If the song sucks, the mix is irrelevant.
Yeah, No, that's absolutely true. Yeah. I talked about this with somebody at NAMM where, you know, I was showcasing the Wolf Audio stuff. We were talking about the console. And he's like, okay, so how much does this console run? I'm like, in its current configuration, it's about 50 grand. He's like, no, I don't think that's worth it right now where I'm at. I'm like, oh, okay, what's going on? Are you like in a project studio or something like that? He's like, no, I just don't have clients that have that nice of a song to warrant mixing it on this console. And I thought that was kind of weird. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, you just don't like your clients? He's like, no, I like my clients. I do. I just think their songs suck. I was like, that's a very interesting take
that's
to
true.
Have,
that's,
but
that's good.
It's
not mutually exclusive. Just because the person's great doesn't mean the song's going to be great, or just because the song sucks doesn't mean the person sucks.
Exactly. So I looked at him like, I guess I wouldn't buy a 50K console to mix songs that I don't like. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, it's also a little bit sad.
Yeah.
A little bit sad. Yeah. I think there's something to be said of that, like, every like, first off, I really believe in the concept that, like, everybody's sexy to someone. So it's like, I like really weird, shitty songs. And when I hear songs that are like underdeveloped, I get excited as a mixer because I'm like, my like savior complex. It's like, I'm going to change this guy's life and show him God with my mix. That's what it's like, you know, a little bit of that sometimes, maybe not always. But there's also the concept. I think another relative application of this second rule is I reposted something on Instagram about like something like, if the artist doesn't like the song, then the mix isn't going to get them to like it, isn't going to change their mind.
Yeah.
And this is something that I find a lot, like where I'll do like a mix for a client and they openly say, like, I'm struggling liking this song. I'm on the fence about it. I've never mixed a song and then, no, that's not true. Not all people that say that don't accept my mix. But every time someone doesn't accept my mix, it's been because they don't like the song.
Mm-hmm.
They change their mind about their own song, or they're insecure about their own song in a different way.
Yeah.
Hard coping, but like I really do see that to be like at least a subjective perspective.
I would say that I don't really have a lot of memory on why somebody didn't like a mix, if I necessarily thought the song was good or if they had like questioned their own song before that or not. But I will say that clients who tended to be easier on revisions were also a lot more confident in putting out more songs more often.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like they were probably second guessing the song or I guess other details of it enough to where they're not hyper fixated on one little thing until they no longer like the song anymore.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
Number three is less relevant to us, and I'm going to explain why in a minute. But number three is working the room. Keeping people happy and relaxed is half of mixing successfully. So that's
that
more of like a recording. Yeah, that's
like
more of a recording thing. And I will say that at least in the current day with mixing and mastering, we rarely ever see our clients.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why I like what I do. I've worked so hard to kind of like remove my neuroticism, to at least keep it in check and control. And I'm not trying to spend more time with other neurotic artists. But that being said, even in the case of me, the way that this is applicable is keeping people happy and relaxed through genuine compliments and through great communication skills via emails and texts is more important than the mix. He says about half of mixing successfully, and I would agree to that. How you present yourself in email, how you present yourself in text, being overwhelmingly optimistic, is nothing but helpful at the very least, if not neutral. And being genuine and finding the good in everything bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So many like communication, charisma skills that you can develop, I think, is half of mixing. Setting expectations, communicating with clients, so good. Anything to add to that before I move on to number four, Lou?
Yeah, there is more of a recording thing. I think it also applies to production, but it's a lot more challenging than people make it out to be, because saying it is a lot easier than maintaining it, depending on the room. I've had difficult rooms where there just seems to be a lot of tension. Let's say that, like in my case, I used to work for a specific artist, depending on the season, right? That artist may have a goal in mind, and the session is starting to derail. And it sometimes falls on the engineer to help get things back on track. So knowing how to manage different personalities and how to get them to move in the direction they need to be moving is actually surprisingly an important skill set. You know, it's something that you never learn in school. It's something that isn't really deeply talked about on YouTube videos because most people are looking up, you know, tutorial videos, right, of how to use this plugin or what does this plugin do. But learning how to manage a room is something that you really do have to learn in person. Like, you could watch a video on it, but until you're actually in the situation and having to think on your feet of how to communicate effectively in a tougher situation, you'd be surprised. It's the difference maker between, like, you know, a certain pay rate or not, you know, because if you can keep things on track, it's not just the artists that take note of this, it's the executives. And that's where I usually made the most of my money, you know, working with certain artists. The executives were the ones that liked me because they saw that I was able to just communicate to the artist, hey, let's keep going.
Yeah.
Keeping the producer out of the artist's ear and keeping the artist where they need to be.
And this is a good one. I need to emphasize that this is not about extroversion. A lot of very introverted people feel bad that they don't have the charisma to be a people person. Yeah. And so they feel like that they would naturally be bad at this. You have no idea how many artists and client prefer someone who just shuts the fuck up.
Yeah.
And like that. So it's like, if you are incredibly introverted or like not very outgoing or not charismatic, right? Being quiet, knowing when to talk, and then most importantly, not reacting and taking things personally. Because just because you're an introvert, if someone like gives you a hard time and like grills you and you become like a human punching bag for their trauma and their inability to communicate properly, you can't freak out and be like, hey, I don't want to work with you anymore. Don't do that. You know, you can't freak out. You have to be calm. And if you can do that, I don't think that there's a net benefit to being an extrovert because,
So
oftentimes I find that engineers don't know how to control the room because they talk too much, not because they talk too little. Very, very, very few scenarios where talking too little was the issue.
Yeah.
Very few scenarios. So extroverted or introverted, it's not about that. Cool. Number four, this is a good one. This is kind of practical. Putting everything proportional in a mix is going to make for a shitty mix.
Ah, okay. So trying to make it to where you can hear everything just as loud as the other, is that?
Yeah. So it's like a lot of people, like, instead of focusing on the craft and the artistic and creative,
balance,
irregularities or like non-balances or, things that stick out, things that take your attention. People like the worst mixes I've ever heard, the most boring mixes and the least emotionally intricate mixes are the ones that everything is mixed to be proportionate and balanced.
Yeah.
And I like the word that he used, proportionate, proportional. Putting everything proportional in a mix is going to make for a shitty mix. I agree with that completely. It's not a game of proportions. It's not a game of balance. This is the one big flaw with mixing and people's interpretations of what mixing is. It's not that. It's balance leads to no emotion. Mixing is enhancing the transference of emotion from a digital or like from the audio platform to the person's heart, from like an audio vibrations to a person's heart. Right, or soul, or whatever. And proportions is not the way to enhance that. It's the opposite, if anything. Things sound overly aggressive, and that aggression is what transfers. Mm-hmm. Things are very intimate because there's so much low end or whatever, and there's lack of compression because it's super dynamic. That intimacy. It can sound romantic. It can sound pleasing, it can sound sexy, it can sound angry, angsty, it can sound happy, it can sound all of these different emotions come from non-proportionate mixing choices.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Lou?
I think it's true. To be honest, I don't have a big issue with being able to hear everything. I have a big issue with things being stagnant volume-wise. Like, there's people who, like, they'll mix a song and there's no, like, you can tell that there's no, like, automation. There's no breathing in the track. And that's, yeah. I guess, the part where, for me, it's like, part of that breathing is allowing certain things to be quiet. Like, also, a synth pad that is used as a bed.
I will say, too, like, even to your point, like, clarifying and removing mud and making sure that everything is heard. Let's say the opposite. Keeping things muddy and making things overlap each
for
other
the vibe.
Adds a level of emotional confusion, frustration, potentially anger, emotional non-clarity, neuroticism. That is an emotion, which when done intentionally sounds good to that, if that's the intended vibe.
Yeah.
So, like, people do think about it backwards. Like, clarity is not for the mixing. The mixing is for the emotion, and sometimes clarity enhances that emotion. Does that make sense? Or vice versa, the opposite, like muddying adds to that emotion. I think that's very, very important to clarify.
Yeah.
Cool. We're good to move on?
Yeah.
Number 5. Gear used on a mix are tools that will make your life either easier or more difficult. They are not what makes a mix good or bad.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've talked about this one enough. We thoroughly agree with this.
Less to be said. I'm just going to read that again and move on to the next step.
Yeah.
Gear used on a mix are tools that will make your life either easier or more difficult. They are not what makes a mix good or bad. Fantastic. Yep. Number 6. A mix can be great and not have great sound. A mix can be great and not have great sound. Why yes? Explain yourself.
Nickelback.
Okay, hold on.
Hold on, I'm not Deadpooling anyone. So I heard this from Greasy Will, and I think it's a funny example because he kind of Deadpooled everybody on this one.
I don't know what Deadpooling means.
Oh, have you ever seen the commercial for Deadpool's movie where his friend's in the hospital, he came to visit and everything? He's like, yeah, it's not something that sucks like Nickelback. He's like, hold on. Nickelback does not suck. And you know who's going to support me on this one? Facts. And he starts reading out all the accomplishments for Nickelback. But at the end of the commercial, they start holding hands, singing together. Never made it as a blind man. But the whole idea behind this is something Greasy Will had mentioned. He's like, Nickelback sounds studio quality, but they don't sound cool. Sometimes cool is better than good. And I have to agree with that. For instance, your Earth, Wind, and Fire, you'll kill the next remaster if they do it, or mixer or whatever. If they had to remix that song, you're like, dude, no, that song does not have to be touched. It sounds cool the way it is. Like, it's great the way it is because of the way the emotion, the way it translates, like, just leave it alone. You know, but if somebody were to touch it, trying to make it better, and it starts to take away from what is special about it now, even though it would be a great mix, it's not a good mix.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes a good mix sounds shitty because that's what makes it cool. I would say this. I got a compliment and a confusing one at that for you, DK, from Nam. I played the song by Carol's daughter, King Baby, on those KSD Line Masters, because I was really curious. I'm like, the low end is so clear. I know it's the Nam floor, but it was Wednesday when no audience was there. Mm-hmm. So, like, we had the cleanest sounding room. There was no outside noise outside of, like, a few people next to us, right? One of the guys there, he listens to the low end. He's like, God damn, that sounds good. That's like, it sounds really filtered out and like muddy, but those kicks, they're clean. And he once he heard the song, he's like, I don't know who the fuck mixed that, but they should be doing that for a living.
Oh, for real? He said that?
Yeah.
And you didn't tell him that this
was
your friend.
No, I didn't tell him. No. No, I only told him that after the fact. And I was like, actually, that's one of my business partners. He just mixed this one. He played at Atlantic on the main masters. And since the line masters are here and they're $65,000 a pair, I had to hear it here. And I got to say, I can hear the financial difference, but I agree with you. There's a reason I use this one as a reference.
Whoa, wow. Oh. That is a nice compliment. Wow. Yeah. Cool.
But it was funny because he initially started, he's like, it sounds so muddy, but it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the difference between a great mix and a good mix. You know, a great mix sometimes is just clear and that's fine, but doesn't necessarily make it good.
Also, how disappointing is it to say something so genuine like, I hope like whoever did this should be doing this for a living, and to find out like, yeah, he has been like,
yeah, it's like, oh, never mind, I guess.
Yeah. Damn. All right. Well, that's wow. That makes me smile. Thank you.
You're welcome. I didn't say it, but you know,
example. What a great example of that. I had a couple other examples of things that I didn't mix.
Yeah.
But like, I think, I'm still blushing, so give me a second here.
Yeah.
Control
yourself, DK.
Like a lot of like hyper pop stuff, like in the almost the entire genre of EDM. His like distorted is really like has no audio. Dynamics, really clipped audio. But that's the vibe. And if it's anything less, then it doesn't sound right. Really hyper intimate jazz or classical recordings where you can hear the mechanics of the upright piano and the pedals, right? You can hear the squeaks of the player squeaking in their chair. Like I listen to a lot of jazz records that are so intimate where you can hear the flaws of like the squeaks in the bench, the creaks of the piano every time he hits the pedal, like, and the strings of the piano sound so close that like you hear all of the mechanical flaws of the piano. That's like not adding to the
like
music.
Like an acoustic guitar with a buzz.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Or like what people realize, like they're trying to take out all of the, have you ever like take it? I know you've done this. Everybody's done this. Like in a pop record, taking out all of the breaths.
Oh yeah.
In
and
between
it sucks the life out of it.
Oh my goodness. It sucks. Yeah. But breaths are annoying, or like DSing way too much.
Yeah. And suddenly they got a lisp.
Yeah. Or just like, I always joke and say like having too much hi-hats, and then you listen to anything by Stevie Wonder and like hi-hats is 90% of the song. And like,
I've got a good live example of this. We were working with Larry something. I wish I could remember his last name, but super, super great rock and roll guitarist, black dude with long dreads. And like, you just see this guy wailing on guitar and he looks so confident and happy as he's doing it. But before him and his band hit the stage, I'm talking to this guy that's supposed to do some guest guitarist work, and I'm like, hey, I saw that there was some changes to the setup and everything, just wanted to go over it with you real quick. He's like, oh, we don't have to, it's rock and roll, man. Like, I'm like, it's rock and roll, that's a line I haven't heard in fucking years. Like, it's rock and roll essentially implies like, listen man, we're doing it live. Like, whatever it is we're doing, we'll just do it live. If we got a saxophone on the stage, we'll just tell him to play in front of the vocal mic. Like, don't overthink it. It's rock and roll, man. Let's do this, you know? And I'm like, all right, cool, whatever, you know? And I've been doing live for so long, I know what that line means.
Yeah.
So I go into the crowd, and the guitars are loud. Bass player has cranked his bass amp up, so I've got drums flying through the speaker system. And I get some of the crowd members saying like, oh my God, this sounds so good. And I'm like, it's because I'm mixing it like a loud rock show. It may not be the greatest mix, but people feel a cannon kick hitting them in the chest. They hear the guitarist wailing and they're just vibing out to everything. And I gotta say, it wasn't the best mix of the night, you know, mix wise, but you could see the reaction in the crowd. So a great mix isn't always a good mix. A good mix is sometimes not Nickelback. You know, it's they've got all the studio budget for all the greatest gear, greatest instruments and everything. But, you know, you've heard the critiques of like, hey, it just doesn't sound that cool. It sounds very studio. And that's part of what makes it lose some of its character.
Yeah. Dirtiness and muddiness is not always something to ameliorate.
No.
Okay. Number seven. Number seven. We're at number seven. If the mix doesn't somehow and in some way annoy someone in the room, the mix likely isn't done. I'm going to read that again?
Yeah. Because I'm like, I felt like the cat with the little loading sign above his head.
If the mix doesn't somehow and in some way annoy someone in the room, the mix likely isn't done.
Okay, hold on.
So, like a good mix, a finished mix.
It has to be annoying to someone.
Annoys someone. One person in the room. And I think the room could be expanded to the world, but I mean, like. You're right. This is philosophically very important about art in general. Like, we've used impressionist paintings like Van Gogh and his pop-ups, and people would be pissed off and says, this is art. This is a disgrace to art. And the fact that it pissed people off is what made it beautiful art. Real art pisses people off.
Yeah.
It's the point of creativity in art is to introduce and normalize new perspectives. And now impressionism is just like, it's $15 at Walmart. It's like the default stock. They pay you to buy their impressionists. They give you money if you take home an impressionist painting. You know, it's,
you know,
they do
what?
It for free on TikTok.
I do have to agree with that. Cause, I'm looking at it outside of the mix now. So outside perspective, if it doesn't annoy somebody in the room, it's likely not done. Let's go back to King Baby. The note they had was like, it's so muddy, but it's so good. That means that something caught their attention. They're now listening. And I hate to say it this way, but like, it's one of those, like, there's got to be a reason to piss somebody off and get them to talk about it, which I think is like Cardi B's whole existence. Where like for a while she was seen as like really ratchety and too wild, too raw, too openly herself online and all that. So there was a lot of hate surrounding her for that character type. But yet it's the number one reason why so many people loved her. There's so many women out there that actually like say like, nah, Cardi B is like my favorite artist. I love her personality. I love her this. But then there's somebody else in the room that would say, no, this is too much. She's got to dial it back. So as far as a mix, it's like there could be that one element that like the artist really thinks is amazing. We were able to put that out into the world. But somebody in the room is going to be like, that's way too much bass. It's like, but that's the vibe.
Yeah.
That's exactly the vibe. I mean, look at the Kendrick stuff. I heard so much of the new GNX album played at NAMM that I have like the album basically memorized. And yet one guy comes up, he's like, but the 808's too compressed. I'm like, that's fucking Compton hip hop, you douche. Of course it is. Like you're probably the guy in the room that's like, no, we can't limit it this hard, but it's still good.
Ya douche.
Ya douche.
What is this? 2005.
Hey, ya man.
Douche. Hey, anyway, that was good.
Have you ever seen the video of the guy winning an argument just by repeating "you douche" over and over again? It just pissed the other guy off so much that, like, you know, I know this guy's obviously the asshole, but I'm suddenly rooting for him because the other guy's letting him win.
That's so funny. No, I think to your point as well, it's like I went to the Jason Joshua thing for NAMM, and he did a thing, and I don't like the way that Jason Joshua articulates his perspective of the world. I don't actually mind the way that he
views
his perspective.
I think
he views things. I think the way that he like regurgitates them in a very inarticulate and generalized fashion, which is neither practical nor helpful 90% of the time. But that being said, one of the things that I really love that he said is our job. He's like trying to be in his seminar thing. He tried to bring back the purpose of like mixer and the art and the creativity of the mixer in the reference perspective of comparison of AI, right? Mm-hmm. And he says, our job is to take risks. And yes, and he's talked about this before. In fact, if you look up a previous video of him being asked, you'll notice it's me in the crowd asking him directly, saying, you've been famous for being quoted for saying, fuck the rough mix, I'm here to make hits, not make your song better or whatever. And I'm like, what do you mean by that? Do you just totally disregard the rough mix? And he more articulate, with more articulation, explain that he does indeed respect the rough, but it's also a balance between his job of respecting the rough and doing what the artist wants, and also taking a risk and doing what's best for the song. And if you articulate and properly emphasize the balance between the two of respecting the original artist's vision and enhancing the craft of mixing through a creative artistic endeavor, which involves some risk, I actually do believe in that completely. And to that point, I do think that it is important to take some regulated and intentional risk.
Yeah.
So I do think that that's important, and it should piss people off. Okay, maybe I'll add the card right now because it's just, I talked about this again.
That was rule 7, right?
Again, this is something that I talk a lot about on my Instagram stories, so I think I'm like accidentally promoting anybody that's not already following me to follow me because I've talked about this and showed a lot of data about this last week. The cognitive bias for today for this episode is declinism. Your bias is declinism. You remember the past as better than it was and expect the future to be worse than evidence suggests it will be. Despite living in the most peaceful and prosperous time in history, many people believe things are getting worse. Use metrics such as life expectancy, levels of crime and violence, and prosperity statistics. Now, you can always isolate a variable, like, for example, greenhouse gases and just general environment as one way to say that the world is declining. Christians will often say, like, sinners and sin and, like, and then use climate change as like evidence of that, right? This is in every single point of data and metric possible. Everything suggests that this is a form of cognitive bias and not at all held by any statistical empirical data. In fact, so much so that the New York Times and the Washington Post has posted in a couple of my favorite articles ever a few examples of this form of cognitive bias, most often seen in music. How often do we hear people say that music was better when I was younger? Music, people have lost the plot on music now. People older than us have said it about music when we were young. People older than them said it about their music when they were young. And we say that now about children that are growing up now.
What was the old song that became very famous when WAP was a thing? Where they're like, oh, WAP is the nastiest song we've ever had put on radio. And it's like, well, you remember this old timey one? It's like, I'll let you lick my hairy nipples.
Okay, hold on. That was more of a joke, though. That's so disgusting. Thank you. But there are a few studies. Hold on. Let me show this one. Let me grab this one first, because I keep these graphs that I love. I'm such a nerd. So like your tendency, like, so when asked, when surveyed, how old were you when you think, and these are all the categories that it questioned, that how old were you when there was the most close-knit communities, the most moral society, the least political division, the happiest families, the most reliable news reporting, the best music, the best radio, the best fashion, the best economy, the best movies, the best television, the best sporting events, the best cuisine? Every single one of these fucking categories is a very, very beautiful peak. Mountain-shaped linear graph. What is that word? What am I looking for? Very obvious graph. All of these is between the ages of 10 and 20. Not a single one peaks at any age higher or any age lower. And this goes beyond like years before birth. So like someone could say the most moral society was 40 years before I was born. And that's also part of the graph. But again, the peak is 10 to 20 year old across the category. Which one has the deepest and highest peak in one singular age is music. In fact, there's another study, which I'm going to try to find out, that did the same exact thing, because these are all self-surveyed. So it's like these are great because it's a belief. Like, not like there's no way to objectify music and say music is objectively better for these reasons. It's all opinions, which makes it even more obvious that it's a cognitive bias. And the one with music was posted from the Department of Data in the Washington Post. The source is The Power of Nostalgia, Age and Preference for Popular Music by Callum Davies, Bill Page, Carl Dreisner, Zach Annesbury, Song Young, and Johan Brewer. And it is, again, years before birth and years old, and the peak of how Americans rate songs based on their age and when songs came out. And it peaks at about 15 years old. And after 31 years of age, there is an obvious data point where nobody thinks that any music after about 30 years of age, there's no music that comes out that people in general think is better or as good as songs when they were 15. So at 30 is when the creativity balances with the cynicism or skepticism. And is no longer, like, statistically, no longer people ever find music that comes out after 30 to be of any benefit to society or any good at all, which is fucking sad to begin with. Mm-hmm. And let's just start there. But it also proves, like, this is a high form of cognitive bias, that there is no data that theory, musical instrumentation, arrangement, and definitely a music technology has any impact on how people perceive music to be good or bad. It is almost certainly and almost near 100% completely perspective. Just age. It's just age. It's just age. So that is declinism manifest in music. So my point in the homework of this episode is make sure you do your due diligence to check your cognitive bias and be open-minded to everything, especially as you get older, because you are objectively false if you dislike things. It is, you are incorrect.
You have an opinion? You're just wrong because of your age.
No, and this is most important for, like, because this is all subjectivity. Because, like, something about, like, the most prosperous economy is an objective, there is an objective for,
there's data sheets to prove.
Yeah, there's, like, objective factual data sets that would prove that this is the best time, that I think most economists could agree upon, that these, we should isolate these variables, but not with music, not with movies. So the point is these are all surveyed. Okay, we're going to move on. Sorry, I'm, like, way over talking about this. Number 8, which is one of my favorites. This is actually a Zen quote that has been moved to, has been reinterpreted for music here. But I love this a lot. I think this speaks highly of how I feel about mixing. Number 8 is, mixing cannot be taught. It can only be learned.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Why okay. So? Why such a hard yes, Lou?
I don't want to say I suffer with imposter syndrome when creating content, but I have a moral dilemma with it. The more I created content, the more comfortable I got with the act of being in front of the camera, which was kind of the biggest goal that I had with putting out YouTube videos. Just because I didn't like the idea of me seeing myself on camera and thinking that I was a know-it-all or come follow me, I'll teach you the best, because I've always said that mixing is very subjective and it's something that is more learned on a case-by-case basis. Like, we don't always use the same roll-offs. We don't always use the same shelves. We don't always use the same compressor styles for every time we get a female vocal or a male vocal. Or if it's hip-hop, it's always a tube tech. You know, it's very much something where you're like, huh, in this situation with this vocalist, with this kind of voice, with this kind of approach to their, you know, delivery of their performance, you know, this compressor doesn't actually work out that great unless you use it in these kind of settings. But it's something where if I were to teach that, somebody would then try those settings and it may not work out for them. And at which point I don't feel like I did them justice in having taught them without explaining, this is a very one-off setting that worked out for this situation. So, you know, take the information that you got and try to apply some of it, but you're only really going to understand it once you've actually put it through its paces. You need experience to really say that you learned something. And I've always been a trial by fire kind of guy. So it's weird because I don't think that content creators are necessarily bad or anything. I think they serve a purpose and they fill a void in the education realm. But mixing is not about learning a single plugin or a single technique used in mixing. Mixing is something where actually learning to be around your clients and understanding communication, you know, and delivering on what was communicated to you as far as intentions, goals, and knowing how to use your tool sets available in front of you for this unique situation is something that experience can only teach. There's no one book, there's no one video, there's no one creator that will ever teach you how to find your great mix, but time will teach you.
Yeah.
Time is something experience. That you have to learn by doing is kind of my viewpoint. And like I said, this is not meant to say that YouTube content is bad or any book is bad. I think it's all great. I think they serve a very specific purpose, but mixing cannot be taught. It can only be learned. That means you have to put in the work. You have to get it. Go do, we've talked about it before. Go do some free mixes. You know, you want to try something new, go mix a song for free, you know, fuck it. If you want to try something new on something where you're getting paid a high dollar, it's a little bit risky, but you know what? Sometimes we're meant to take that risk at that moment. But if you want to try something new and see if it works out for you and see how people react to it, you know, go break somebody off a deal on something that you can take the risk on. But, you know,
yeah,
it's that's my moral dilemma with that. You know, like I said, I think you really have to put in your time more than you have to watch the videos at a certain point.
This is the problem with how societies use religion to unintentionally create social caste systems among societies across history of time, across every society and every religion, because you have to dumb things down enough for it to be accessible to the working man.
Yeah.
Like, to the farmer in the medieval ages doesn't have time to graduate seminary and to learn Greek and Latin to be able to fucking read the Bible, you know? Mm. So it unintentionally becomes, and this is for Buddhism, this is across the board, across all religions, across all times. In fact, Japan had a war over Buddhism and created the three new Buddhisms that came from the old Buddhisms. That were strictly because the lower class revolted and they wanted Buddhism and their religion to be more accessible to everybody else. And it accidentally became a high class thing that only wealthy, high class people were able to actually study their religion. So like, because
that's
it was
such
so
a weird twist. I didn't know that.
And yeah, so that's part of the, so like this is, well, because Buddhism is not necessarily like super like, In Japan is not super theologically heavy. Like there's no like real literal concept of, well, yeah. Anyway, it's a lot less real. Like Christians literally believe in God and in heaven. Right.
Yeah.
So it's not for any sort of moral salvation. It's just like, yo, just make it accessible to us. Yeah. You know, like,
yeah.
And I think that this is what, this is the problem, the dilemma, what you're speaking on exactly to education and doing something that is a lot more open and subjective is you have to break down these very nuanced and subjective topics in a way that will piss off those that are very experienced and people that don't have much experience will only value those things, will only value. Yeah. And then if you make any sort of content about mixing easily accessible or like understandable to the average layman, then what happens is you miss out on the nuance.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the truth with so many things beyond art. This is a problem with I'm not going to go on to a philosophical rant because everybody's sober right now and we're trying to keep it that way. And
everybody's sober right now and we want to keep it that way.
I think we're doing a good job.
That's so funny. I think everybody's already taken 3 shots because of me.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Anyway, mixing cannot be taught. It can only be learned. This is one of those things. I mean, even practically, like super practical use case. You go to school and you learn how a patch bay works and you learn how the routing of your SSL console at the studio at the school. And then you go to any fucking studio with an SSL console and it turns out that for some reason, however they patch the patch bay is completely different. And they're aware of it. It's like, hey, I know that other studios patch this differently, but like you're going to have to relearn everything at the studio anyway. And then like also our SSL console, like channels 12 and 14 don't work. And also like the aux routing for channels 2 and 7 don't work as well. So you're going to have to do this and this. And it's like, and you have to relearn everything anyway.
Yeah.
That's like a perfect example. Like, it can't really be taught. Like, because every single studio, even in the most technically absolute things that should be standardized, are never standardized.
Yeah.
I think that's okay. And I think with the real skill of mixing is problem solving. And this is where the creativity of mixing is. Like, how you address, like, first off, what is the problems to be solved? It's more based on an emotional enhancement. Like, we need more aggression in this. Okay, the kick drum is too soft. So the problem is, now we dictate the problem, which being able to dictate what the problem and articulate what the problems are is the first step of the creative process. Okay, I'm deciding subjectively that the kick drum may be leading to the problem of a lack of aggression in this song, which I'm assuming that the artist is intending. This is a ton of assumptions, right? Already. Even deciding what the problem may be is like four layers of assumptions that is based on my personal experiences and what I've learned and what I've determined. So I'm brave enough and courageous enough or have enough experience to determine that this is the problem that is to be solved, and I articulate that. How do you solve this kick drum issue to make it more aggressive? Okay, first off, you need to know what the solution sounds like and have a solution in mind. And on top of that, you have to creatively solve this problem based on your tools and limitations that you already have to achieve this arbitrary and completely subjective solution that you already have come up with yourself.
Yeah.
Because there's no fucking such thing as a kick drum. Objectively, that sounds more aggressive. What the fuck does that mean?
Yeah.
So, do you see how many deep layers of nuanced subjectivity there is in just that single track, let alone an entire song? So, the reason why mixing can't be taught is because you have to develop this ability to assume, to have the confidence in your assumptions, and to solve problems so open-ended that only you will come to that conclusion in that way. There is, this is the thing that people forget about mixing and why it's so creative and why, although it's so technical, why it will always be a creative skill. Someone clip that and send it to me, post it on YouTube, post it on Instagram. That is like the best example of why mixing is creative and so many other things. Why mixing cannot be taught and only can be learned. Okay, cool. Number nine. The overall vibe of the track is much more important than any individual part. The overall vibe of the track is much more important than any individual part.
I would agree significantly with that. That's I don't know why this one. To be fair, I understand why it's on the list, but I also don't understand why it's on the list, because it should come as a given. I guess an easy one to correlate this one with is forget about EQing things in solo unless there's a very specific thing you're trying to do, because that one track needs to fall in line with the rest of the track. You know, you want it to be within context, whatever changes you're making, but the sum of the song is much more important than any one individual track. Is so important that there are tracks that are going to make the vibe be enhanced. But if that one track is essentially the focal point and everything else falls behind it, that means the sum of the rest of the work put into it is now being lost. I like this for the song Till Now by Banks. It's the same reference song I use for every monitor, because there's like vocoder, there's like panning, there's a really mid-rangey thin vocal going on. There's a lot going on. But I would argue that it's a good mix, not a great mix, if that makes sense. Kind of like what we talked about earlier, where there are parts of it that are muddy or weird. It's there's a lot of angst in the style of mixing behind it, right? But sometimes it's hard to tell if the instrumentation is the most important part or if the vocals is the most important part. And I really like that about it, because it's got a lot of push and pull in the balance. But I could not tell you if one element was worked on more or not. I feel like all of them have a very specific role to fill. And because of that, I think it's a good mix.
Yeah.
But anytime I can hear one thing really standing out, like it really feels like it's a focal point and it's unintentionally that, that's when I'm like, that needs to change. Like you mentioned earlier, Stevie Wonder hi-hats. I don't think anybody ever listens to Stevie Wonder hi-hats and thinks that needs to go down. But if they were a little bit louder, we might all be
More importantly, I think there's a lot of people that think that it needs to go down. But after they put it down, they realize, oh, that just changed the vibe way too much, actually. I regret ever wanting that.
Like Wolfpack, I really like that. Like some of their mixes just sound old-timey, even though they have all access to new stuff. Because it fits a vibe more than it fits the quality of the recording. Which I think is, once again, the Nickelback argument. There's great and there's cool.
Yeah, I don't think there's much to say that about this that can already be interpreted, and with your beautiful explanation. Number 10.
That was an ugly explanation.
All right, fine. Ugly explanation. Just horribly, dude, we can tell that you're retarded. And number 10.
Yes. You're fully diagnosed, fully aware of it, embracing it. Loving life. You know what? Give me a cheese.
Dude, that was the funniest thing. During NAMM, I will.
Come on, you can't contemplate whether you should say something or not, or else you're going to get people drunk.
Yeah, that's right. That's me. Yeah, that's one of the drinking game rules. Okay, so here, I'll just say it. But know that I understand that this can be taken out of context and be horrible. But I'm going to say it anyway because I'm a Gryffindor and I'm brave, right? No, I'm just kidding. There was two friends that shall not be named that met each other for the first time. They're both kind of awkward people. And both of them, they were like, yeah, yeah. And they were talking about their kids. And then all of a sudden, one like forced up the conversation. But we were talking about school ratings and how some areas of schools are good. And then one brought up the idea that like, yeah, but like some of the schools that are high rated, like have a different rating for how they treat their special needs kids, which is a valid point. And then he's like, yeah, because my kid is autistic and he goes to special ed. Which kind of led into this like reactionary pity party. And then the other person's like, oh yeah, wow, I'm autistic too, I understand. And then they were like, it kind of went into this like, it felt a little off. It wasn't just like, they started virtue signaling to each other. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, oh, okay, yeah. And then I'm like, and then I entered the conversation. I was just listening, and it was the three of us. And I was just like, oh, yeah? Well, my kid's just regular retarded. I don't know. I just felt that was like a super funny moment. And shout out to all the retards out there. You're
you're heard, you're seen, you're validated, you're loved.
Yeah. I'm a morally virtuous person for showing empathy. sorry. That was dumb. I apologize. I don't. I don't care. Number 10, just because a part was recorded doesn't mean it needs to be in the mix.
Yes.
Just because a part was recorded doesn't mean it needs to be in the mix. I feel like this is more of like a producer thing.
It is, but I've had conversations with people in the past over, they'll say, hey, if you hear something in the mix that you think should be quieter, just doesn't need to be there, it doesn't help, feel free to make that decision. You know, so some people have communicated freedom to make that decision, though I try my best to make as little decisions of that nature as possible, because obviously I want to respect the work put in. But if you got five fucking snares, and two of them are the same one, and you thought that making two of them make them stereo, I'm sorry, I'm taking one of them out. But like, I've seen some like production things that actually factually didn't serve a purpose. They were just like duplicated channels, and it started to cause like I've seen people do like they try to do like a stereo thing by taking one track and then delaying it by like a couple milliseconds and then panning it left and right. But then when you listen to it, you're like, it just sounds out of phase. It doesn't actually sound stereo. It just sounds out of phase. Then you take the track, you use only one track, put it through a nice wide stereo reverb and put like a little bit of like slapback delay going on it or something of that nature. And it just sounds much better. So in those cases, yeah, like not everything that's there needs to be there. But if we're talking takes, right, and we're talking like vocal performance differences and things like that, and you're like, you know, that low harmony doesn't really fit a need, you don't necessarily have to take it out. You could just lower the volume. You can make it like a supplemental tone, which I actually really like for vocal mixing. Sometimes when I hear that lower octave harmony and you're just like, ooh, I like that you kept that in there. If it was any louder, it would be distracting, but it's like perfectly low enough to where it's just audible if you're really paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that's something that like Leslie Brathwaite is known, has said many times, like sometimes when you have like a producer sends you like a kick with like 10 layers, or even if it's just five, and then he deletes like four of them, or almost all but one or two of them, and then the producer's like, how did you get the kick to be so punchy? I struggled so hard with that. He's like, no, I just deleted most of them. And
it's true.
Anyway, there is a number 11, which is funny. Because it's 11 out of 10, because it's a list of 10 and it's 11 out of 10. That's a music reference. Number 11 is be aggressive. And it says, oops, that's 11. Number 11 is be aggressive.
I like that it says, oops, that's 11. Yeah, I actually find that very charming.
Turning it up to 11 is, what is that? That's from a that's music movie.
What was it? Something Back or Slick or Slight? It's the metal comedy, like parody. It's like, oh, well, this one goes to 11. It's like, oh, well, why don't they just make 10 louder?
Well, Spinal
Tap, that's what it is. But this one goes one louder. Yes, I understand, but like, why don't they just make 10 sound one louder? Well, then what would the 11 be for?
Anyway, so number 11 is be aggressive. And I think that that's true. I have a good example for this. Very emotional people are really good at overgeneralizing and using emotions to come to a conclusion rather than logic. Famously so. That's not necessarily a bad thing. In the world of Googleable truths and facts, it's a horrible thing. But in the world of art, it is the only thing. Okay? So here's the thing. In real life, let's say in a political debate, how you feel is difficult to convince any, it is difficult to create any power or pull behind it to convince anyone. Mm-hmm. That being said, if you have the ability to overgeneralize and to use anecdotes for proof emotional stories to prove a point, this is beyond politics. Sorry, I'm not trying to... trying to cut people, single people out or ideas out. Or if you have this ability that serves, that seems to not really serve your purpose in a logical debate, you should use that innate and beautiful ability and talent to overgeneralize, to exaggerate emotions in a mix. That's what I think it means to be aggressive with the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Use those anecdotal moments in a mix to build a song. Use that guitar solo way too loud. Make the hi-hats way too loud or whatever. 808's way too loud. Over-exaggerate those emotions and those things in the mix to really... really cut the clear on the emotions. That is a talent that most people that are overly clinical and overly logical cannot do.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. I once got a mix note that it took me a while to understand, which has everything to do with this. And it was kind of impressive that it was said so short. A mix that I worked on years ago, this is like 12 years ago. It was like one of my first opportunities to really work on a lot of big names on a single album and names that I'll still use on my credits and stuff, which was cool. But because of that, I had like that personal sense of pressure to do as best as I could at the time with what I had. The note that I got back wasn't like, oh, this is too loud or this sounds muddy. It was, I like the mix, but it's too safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's too safe.
safe or try hard? Like it's also very obvious when someone is like not confident enough to like put themselves out there. So it just sounds like every other pop artist ever right now, currently. And it just sounds like they're a try hard. So like among safe, it's also a try hard to me. Like, don't sound like a try hard. Sound, try to be authentic. And being authentic is not only like to do, first off, to be able to recognize your biases, to notice that you're not doing it, is a skill that most people don't have. Most people don't realize that they're being controlled by their need to conform to society. This is not something that is obvious to any single person. This is part of the ego. And ego is famously something that cannot be seen by the person who has it, right?
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. Second off, if you are gifted enough to be able to see and reject the societal expectations, and you are gifted to be creative and fully be authentic, you should completely dive into that.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing with art, is most people aren't even capable of recognizing that they're not doing that properly. And this is something that, like, I'm very conscientious. I'm very, like, high in conscientiousness. I'm very logical. I'm very data-driven. But I am, like, just somehow creative and open enough that I'm hyper-aware of when I'm being inauthentic and doing things to serve a virtue signal, and to do things for the optics of looking moral, or the optics of looking to conform with people. I'm very aware of those things. And that's to my benefit, because I'm also, as much as I'm really good at using logic, as you can tell from this podcast, when I go on deep dark rants, I'm also very good at using anecdotes to prove a point and overgeneralizing and using emotions to prove a point. I'm also very good at that. And that is the skill that I use most when I'm mixing.
Yeah.
So in that point, do overgeneralize, do overuse your emotions, do be authentic, and do be aggressive when you do so. Be aggressively authentic.
That's going to be a lot of nerding out at the studio for me, so I will choose to dial it back a little.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a good episode, I think.
I think
so,
too.
We had a lot
of
good thoughts. I think there's a lot of clippable moments from this episode that I need to do. This episode is sponsored by the Mixed Media Podcast.
A regular retarded kid. What was it?
Yeah, that's the clippable moment.
That was a clippable moment. Things DK says out of context.
My kid is just regular retarded. Yeah, I have.
Actually, that's probably the next Discord question. Favorite out of context lines that each has said.
No, I'm not going to go on that tangent. I think we've already gone long with this episode.
Yeah.
but there's a lot of tangents I can go with that. But thank you for listening. This episode currently does not have a direct sponsor other than our general normal partners, which is Latin Audio and Terrace. And Plugin Boutique, Sweetwater, those things can be found by going to mixingmusicpodcast.com and going to our sponsors page and clicking on those links. We do get a kickback if you go to Sweetwater, so mixingmusicpodcast.com/Sweetwater. Just any small purchase, you'll give us like 20 cents. It's great. A collection of 20 cents is great. And many 20 cents make it worth it. Someone maliciously reported us and cost us 2 weeks of SEO momentum. So please help us recover that by leaving a 5-star rating or review on the podcast if you like this episode. Leave comments, just interact with this podcast in one way or another, especially if you've liked us enough to come to this far into this episode. Anything helps, really, truly. And then lastly, I don't know what the current state of the exclusive episodes will be at the time that you hear this episode, but if they do exist, and when they do exist, it will always be mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. Yeah, so around $4 a month, you get access to hundreds of more technical episodes where me and James, or me and Braden, break down various different ideologies and technical production tips, and we address the nuance of all of those things. Again, that's very, very important to do. We address the nuance of all these technical tips that have been given on the internet. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
If you love the Mixing Music Podcast but want deeper, ad-free, technical episodes, we've got you covered. Our Patreon gives you access to over 250 exclusive episodes and new content every single week, all focused on mixing, mastering, and engineering at a high level. For just $4 a month, you get practical tips and techniques that will instantly improve your sound. Join now at mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive.